Welcome to episode 57 of Junk Filter. My name is Jesse Hawken, and my returning guest is Robin Citizen. She's the senior manager of festival programming for TIFF, and she knows a thing or two about the horror genre. Robin, welcome back to Junk Filter.
Thanks for having me. We had so much fun last time.
Well, we're talking about another 80s movie, this time a great horror movie, and at the time, an extremely controversial film. It's the 1987 psychological horror film Angel Heart, directed by Alan Parker, starring Mickey Rourke and Lisa Bonet with a, quote, special appearance by Robert De Niro, unquote. Before we get going with this discussion, a lot of the power of Angel Heart depends on knowing nothing in advance. So we recommend that you see the film before listening to this episode, because yes, we are going to be spoiling a 34-year-old movie on this program.
Few films have ever created this much anticipation. Believe everything you've heard, because nothing can prepare you for the ending of Angel Heart.
Are you afraid?
Yeah, I'm afraid.
Mickey Rourke, Robert De Niro, Lisa Bonet, Angel Heart, rated R. Starts Friday at a theater near you.
Robin, I want to hear first about your relationship with the horror movie genre. I know this is one of your specialties.
Yeah, I mean, I think the horror movie genre got me into film in general. So I was reading horror stories very young. At 7 and 9, I was reading like Edgar Allan Poe, and 9, Stephen King. I don't know what drew me to horror, because my parents are so not interested and very not down with it. But because I was reading so much, I think that was a battle they just didn't want to fight. But when I started getting into film later, being an anxious kid and being an anxious adult, there's certain benefits to horror where you feel like you're getting a chance to kind of play out the worst case scenario over and over again. But you're safe, but you're like, oh, if I were in that position, I don't know if I would do that or I could do this. And so it's like a theater of your anxieties, which really appealed to me. But actually, when I went to grad school for film, I studied like ethno-racial identity in film, and really looking at Japanese film and blackness in film. But the way I got into Japanese film was through Japanese horror. So from there, I kind of went back into the classic stuff.
Oh, so like the modern J-horror stuff was your entry?
It was. I mean, it sounds super cliche, but I feel like it's The Ring, you know? Like I saw a VHS copy of The Ring, which is absolutely how you should see The Ring. And yeah. It was so different than the horror I was used to, which was very much like 80s slasher, you know, Freddy, not so much Jason, but like Michael Myers. And the fact that most of the villains or monsters in J-horror were women, and they were kind of like sympathetic. I mean, and sympathetic in a different way than Freddy or Michael become kind of the heroes of the film because they're the big personalities, like, but genuinely sympathetic in how they became monstrous. It was just so different. And so I started watching, I think Kiyoshi Kurosawa films were like my gateway drug, because he's kind of like a very good blend of like art house and horror. So with that bridge, I was into like very classical Japanese stuff very quickly.
The movie that he made called Cure is one of the scariest movies I've seen in my life.
So disturbing. And like Cairo or like Pulse or whatever. Yes. I used to show that in my Asian horror cinema class. And the kids would start out, they're like 19 or 20, but they would start out making fun of it because they had the whole like AOL, like, you know, when you're signing on. And they're like, oh my gosh, professor, you're so old. But by the end, they would be really unnerved because it's so creepy and so strange.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorites.
To get into Angel Heart, how did you first see this movie?
Like I saw most movies, which was kind of rented in my room. Like my parents had a TV in my room because they knew I liked movies. But I think I must have been 13 or 14. So, but I remember it coming out. So I guess I was 7 when it came out, and I remember all the hubbub because I used to watch The Cosby Show, and it was like this big deal that, you know, Lisa Bonet, who was clearly had it, was going to be in this movie, and like nobody knew what the movie was about yet. Mm-hmm. And then when it came out, I remember the scandal. And now looking back at it, the audacity of Bill Cosby to be mad at her, that's some audacity. But I saw it, you know, videotape in my room, and I was really just weirded out by it at first. And I found it very unnerving, and I did not see the twist coming. But the visual poetics of the film really stuck with me, because I think it was one of the first films I had seen where you have this kind of recurring imagery that's not directly connected to the narrative. Like, it's not like, you know, a linear point A to point B, but it felt like a terrible fever. There was like a nightmarish quality to it, like this recursive quality that you can't figure it out easily. It doesn't lend itself to a simple interpretation. So I was kind of fascinated.
Well, we'll discuss the plot soon, but I went to see Angel Heart on opening night in 1987 when it opened, because I was a huge fan of Mickey Rourke. For me, he was like, the way I would describe him is that, like, in a decade full of sort of non-movie stars, like, and sort of, you know, Rob Lowe kind of, Patrick Swayze sort of guys, you know, the cast of The Outsiders were thought of as the hot new young actors. And I guess Tom Cruise was coming up in there. Mm-hmm. But Mickey Rourke, to me, felt like he was the only guy that was carrying on this tradition of acting that felt to me in that lineage of actors like Marlon Brando and James Dean and Montgomery Clift. Like, he just seemed to be just much further ahead than all the other actors. He didn't really want to be a movie star, to me. Like, and the list of the movies that he turned down, if you compare that to the list of the movies that he made as a young actor, he had very good taste in projects at the beginning, and he chose to work for the most part with important directors on artistic projects. One of the movie where he first made a splash was in Body Heat.
Yeah.
Where he played the guy who was helping William Hurt with his plan to, like, you know, kill Kathleen Turner's husband so that they could, you know, the double indemnity sort of plot. And he made a major impression in a very small amount of time on screen as his sort of explosives expert.
That's right. Like, I remember going back and watching that movie when I was older, and it being one of those things where you're like, wow, he's stealing this scene from William Hurt, who's like a formidable actor himself, but just the kind of coiled charisma that Mickey Rourke had. I wanted to see like a spin-off movie of that character.
Yeah. He was in Michael Cimino's Heaven's Gate. He was in Diner, where he also distinguished himself. He was in a Nicholas Rogue movie called Eureka. Mm-hmm. He was in Rumblefish. He was just carrying on like this sort of quality roles and method acting, which seemed to be a lost art in the 80s. Mm. I found out that Mickey Rourke was admitted into the Actors Studio on his first audition, which is very, very unusual. They just saw him and they said, "You're in."
Yeah.
He was also not afraid of being in problematic material. You know, my problematic fave, Year of the Dragon, the Michael Cimino film.
I knew you were going to say that.
Sorry. But, like, you know, it's a real movie star performance, and in a time where there weren't a lot of movie stars. He was in 9.5 Weeks, which was another film that got in ratings trouble. And then, most controversially, Alan Parker's Angel Heart. Adrian Lyne had a very interesting quote, because he directed 9.5 Weeks. Adrian Lyne said that if Rourke had died after making Angel Heart, he would have become a bigger phenomenon than James Dean.
I haven't heard that.
Like, who is this incredible actor? He did all these amazing performances and then he died in a car accident or whatever. Like, he would have been huge back then. And 1987 was arguably Rourke's year, because he was in Angel Heart. He was in this movie called A Prayer for the Dying, where he played an IRA terrorist. Mm-hmm. Not a very good movie, but a very ambitious performance by Rourke. And he actually got in trouble with the producer of that film because he played a IRA terrorist, and he got down with a dialect coach he got down a very, very heavy duty Northern Ireland accent that actually enraged the producer because you couldn't understand anything he was saying. Like, he was so mad. And then also Barfly.
Yes.
Where the Bukowski film, where people were saying that it was like an award caliber performance. But it was around this point that Rourke started to self-destruct. He fell into the sort of trap that a lot of method actors get into. Brando said this kind of stuff too, where he said that acting wasn't a masculine profession and that he had no respect for himself as an actor. He tended to wear his heart on his sleeve. You know, like he took things very personally. And he was apparently very difficult to work with as an actor. Mm-hmm. Kim Basinger had an amazing put down of him. She called him the human ashtray. They were working on 9.5 weeks together.
Attractive.
I know. Just chain smoking. One funny story there. I used to get my hair cut at a place in Kensington Market, and they had filmed that movie called Picture Claire in the hair salon. Mm-hmm. It was a Bruce McDonald movie where they got Mickey Rourke in, and the woman who was cutting my hair said, yeah, they were filming this Mickey Rourke movie in here last week. He was actually sitting in this chair. Looked down on the floor, and I looked down on the painted floor, and it was covered in cigarette burns. And they said, yeah, that was Rourke. He just chain smoking and letting all the cigarettes hit the ground and burn the painted floor. It was really gross.
Ew.
Here's a list of the movies that Rourke turned down in the 80s. 48 Hours. Beverly Hills Cop. That was a vehicle for Mickey Rourke. It turned into one for Eddie Murphy. He turned down Top Gun. He turned down Rain Man. He turned down The Silence of the Lambs. And he numerous times turned down Tarantino. Tarantino wanted him for both Pulp Fiction and for Death Proof. I think he wanted him in the Travolta role. Or no, either the Travolta or the Willis role in Pulp Fiction and the Kurt Russell role in Death Proof. But Rourke didn't want to work with Tarantino.
He would have been great in the Bruce Willis role. Oh my God. He would have just killed that.
I know. But instead, he wanted to do Harley Davidson and the Marlboro Man.
Oh.
It's just like, what's wrong with you? But in the 80s, he was the guy. He was the man. And so I went to see Angel Heart just because it was the new Mickey Rourke movie and Robert De Niro was in it. For me, in the 80s, Rourke and De Niro on screen together was like the Pacino and De Niro coffee scene in Heat. Mm-hmm. It was like the two great actors of the time facing off against each other. Also, we should point out that both Robert De Niro and Al Pacino played the devil.
That's true. Devil's advocate. Yep.
Yeah. So anyway, so this was like a real showstopper performance for Mickey Rourke, but the movie is so dark and depressing. And maybe we should get into your response to this movie when you saw it.
I mean, yeah. And my response was basically, well, I was really, I think I saw it actually for Lisa Bonet and De Niro, because mm-hmm. I was aware of Mickey Rourke, but his main claim to fame at that age was 9.5 weeks, which I was too young to watch. So yeah. I had kind of just heard who he was and seen him and recognized, you know, that he was a really good looking guy. But I don't know, at 13, you're into like, you know, like teeny bop, like non-threatening looking men, and not like Mickey Rourke, who always looked filthy and had a very sexual vibe about him. So I definitely wasn't watching for him. I was watching for Lisa Bonet to see what kind of work she had done. And I definitely thought she had been in more of the film than she was. But I was completely blown away by this part. And what was interesting is that he played this detective with so much intelligence. Like, I guess so much of the stories I'd heard about Mickey Rourke really emphasized like his masculinity and kind of, you know, this very like Dean Brando, more so than Clift, I think, which had a sensitivity about him. But he, you know, like the kind of investigation part of it, there was a real kind of intellect that came across, and I was very impressed, but I was also very freaked out by the kind of viciousness of the story ultimately.
Yeah. Yeah. So I went to see Angel Heart on opening night, and I thought that it was one of the most striking movies visually and atmospherically that I had ever seen. It really has incredible feeling to it. The way that the sound is mixed, the use of that electronic score with the saxophone solos, the amazing period detail. Like, you can see that they dressed blocks and blocks of the sets in both New York and in New Orleans. And as you said, the repeating imagery, all these things that you keep seeing over and over again and seeing more and more of where it's going. But this is an indicator of how good this movie was. It's so incredibly obvious in many ways where this movie is going, but I had no idea. And I was, it was like the rug got pulled out from under me at the end of the movie. I knew that Robert De Niro was the devil because Louis Cipher is his name. So I knew that much. But I honestly thought that Mickey Rourke was being framed by the devil and that he was an innocent man who was being set up by the devil as a murderer.
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought too. I mean, I actually didn't get the Louis Cipher thing until the very end.
I did not see the ending coming. And when I saw The Sixth Sense, I didn't see that ending coming either. I felt actually really dumb when The Sixth Sense was over because I did not see it coming. I was wondering what was going on with this movie. I took some of the misdirection in that movie as bad directing. Like, I was like, I don't understand why nobody's talking to him. You know, like, how come the only person talking to him is the kid? That's so weird. And then at the end, it was like, aha, I got fooled. Like, I did not see that coming. And that's how I felt about Angel Heart. I was like stunned that, in fact, I mean, we'll get into the plot, but it was the story of Faust, is what I realized at the end.
Yeah, no. And that's kind of the genius of this film, because this is a really familiar story. Like, everybody knows the Faustian bargain and everybody knows the Robert Johnson myth, which is a bit closer and a bit more popular culture. And the fact that everybody kind of knows that, and this involves a musician, and I still didn't pick it up until they basically were explaining what happened. I mean, as I said, I didn't even understand the Louis Cipher kind of anagram until he actually spelled it out. And I was like, oh, right, Lucifer. So I think you're just so caught up in the details of the film that you're not trying to like do a metaphysical plot twist analysis.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's that scene where he's unpeeling that egg, where he's talking to Harry Angel, the detective, and he says, some cultures think that the egg is the soul, you know, is the symbol of the soul. Would you like an egg? And then he eats the egg in front of him and it's like, what's that? This guy is so weird. You know? It's like, and when you watch the movie again, it's like staring you right in the face.
Yeah, no, he gives himself away and he eats it like in a particularly disgusting way. It's like all in one bite. And
and he's got like a pentagram ring and long fingernails, which, by the way, keep getting longer throughout the movie. And he dresses like nobody was dressing in 1955, like with the huge Martin Scorsese beard and the big hair.
I actually talk about that quite a bit. When I went back and watched the film, my connection was Martin Scorsese. And I thought at one point Alan Parker or Robert De Niro had actually said that was his influence. But then I went back and did some research and it seems like that was something that's a connection Ebert had made or something.
Oh.
That just became like part of kind of popular discussions about the film. Mm-hmm. But he also looks like a kind of pseudo Dracula figure. Like, he looks very old world. He looks very aristocratic. He looks, you know, like a gentleman monster. But at the time it just came across as strange. And it wasn't until I was a bit older and really put it in its period setting, like, oh, this was the '50s and this was shot in the '80s and it was set in the '50s. And neither of these times had people looking like this.
Yeah. Well, Robin, you want to take a swing at describing the plot of Angel Heart?
I can. So it's set in 1955. We meet Harry Angel, who is a private eye in Brooklyn. He repeats this several times throughout the film that he's from Brooklyn. And he was in the war. And he's now kind of a private investigator, and he's contacted by a lawyer named Weinsapp, who asks him to come for a meeting in this church in Harlem because he has a client that needs somebody to be found. So he goes to this church in Harlem, of all places. This is 1955, and he is white. And he meets Robert De Niro's character, Louis Cypher. And Louis Cypher is looking for Johnny Liebling, the real name of a crooner, Johnny Favorite, who has gone missing. So Johnny Favorite was in the war, and he got what they called shell-shocked back then, but he also was quite disfigured, and he was in an institution, and he was supposed to be in this institution for quite some time, but Weinsapp was visiting this institution just by chance and learned that he was no longer there. So basically, Harry needs to find Johnny Favorite because he owes something to Mr. Cypher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Cypher wants to settle some accounts, basically.
Yes.
This whole movie is about the settling of accounts.
Mm-hmm.
So the first part of this movie takes place in New York City. Parker adapted the novel for a screenplay, and he made the decision to set the movie in the mid-50s and not the late-50s, but crucially also to move the action from New York City to New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to talk to you about that decision.
I actually think that's the decision that made this an iconic film, because there's plenty of noirs set in this very urban space of, you know, like New York or LA. And I think what makes this interesting is that a lot of the case happens from people that were living in the South. And of course, the kind of folk religions and voodoo, like some version of Hollywood voodoo that happened in the film, you know, has its origins and practice in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a really interesting way to look at the differences between racism and how it was practiced in the North and in the South. And I think he makes some really very interesting comparisons from how the case is conducted in Harlem, where Harry is very much an outsider and at a disadvantage because he's in these black spaces. But mm-hmm. the black people in Harlem have autonomy over those spaces. So at one point he is like very roughly thrown out of a church when he gets out of line. And yeah. There's a kind of enforced parity there because it's like this bubble of it's a like bubble of a black community, and they kind of are shown as kind of running things in that bubble. In New Orleans, it's the oppression, like the kind of white supremacy, is much clearer. It's a kind of constant presence by these racist police, and there's also the tragic mulatto figure. So the specter of like interracial mixing, and that whole history is inextricably linked to the slavery, is much more obvious.
You know, another thing I was thinking while I was watching this movie is that the movie has a very sardonic approach to the portrayal of the church in Harlem, that there seems to be some level of corruption. For instance, the devil is meeting, like the devil's found a place to have this meeting with Harry Angel in this black church run by this preacher man, who's the main preacher, is like collecting money from the parishioners. And then there's also that scene where he's being like walked through the street in this huge
yes.
procession where he's on a throne.
Yes.
And this movie also has all this weird, I don't know how you feel about it, but there are all these genres of African-American musical culture in the film, right? Like there's gospel music, there's the blues, there's jazz, there's the music that's used in the voodoo ritual and stuff. And it's all supposed to be menacing. This movie is just shot through scene after scene, makes you uncomfortable and really, really on edge.
It does. I mean, it immerses you in those spaces. And I think this is why Angel Heart was kind of, it was viewed unkindly, and as that all the stereotypes meant that it was this racist film or like an anti-black film. And I think there's certainly enough superficial kind of signifiers that would you know, point to that, you know, like, you know, how it depicts voodoo, how it depicts kind of these black spaces, how it's kind of connected to corruption and death whenever he goes into these spaces. But I think when you look at the film as a whole, it's just as important to recognize that none of the black practitioners of voodoo, with the exception of Pastor John, who lives in the North, use voodoo for like any that we see their own like, you know, enrichment, not even to protect themselves from other like racist police officers or anything like that. So they practice it. It's their religion, but they're not using it for like greedy, ambitious purposes, but they do help Johnny Favorite use it for that purpose. And there's not a single white character in this film that looks anything but despicable. So I think like we see a lot of black characters victimized, but the white characters are the source of horror. And it's like, their like greedy ambition, you know, the lust. Mickey Rourke is constantly like lusting after somebody in this movie. And so I think this space in Harlem, and I love this part of the movie because Pastor John is a prosperity preacher. Yes. He's just a full on like, I'm his messenger. If you love God, you want me to have a Rolls Royce. Yeah. Please put money in this basket. And so, and that for me, that was so familiar because I mean, I grew up in Houston. We have these huge mega churches. This is like Joel Osteen's, you know, home. We have T.D. Jakes and Creflo Dollar. And so prosperity gospel is a real thing. And there's some kind of understanding in the community that a lot of these people are corrupt and they're enriching themselves really at the mercy of their parishioners.
Yeah.
And so I think this preacher is portrayed as like this false god when he's being carried in the streets. He's very much like the golden sheep, right? Or is it the lamb? I'm a terrible lapsed Catholic. I don't remember exactly what the parable was, but we see him getting toppled because he's made himself into this false idol.
Yes. And that's a big hilarious moment, right? Because there's a big foot chase that goes into this parade and Rourke basically gets out of the jam by knocking over Pastor John.
Yeah.
And that whole scene is shot in a very epic way. Again, with the great production design in this film, like you can see that they've dressed about five or six blocks. Mm-hmm. And Parker also said something very interesting when they were scouting locations for Angel Heart, that he basically didn't want to see anything in this movie that we've already seen in a movie set in New York. And in the 80s, all you had to do was go to Harlem.
Yeah.
And to have the movie take place in the 50s, I mean, there are some parts of Harlem that still feel like 40 or 50 years ago. It was very easy to get the period detail.
Yeah, it was. And it's true.
This was before gentrification, obviously.
Yeah, I know. I'm like, now parts of Harlem look like Park Slope.
or they look like Parkdale.
Yeah. Oh, God, we're like laughing, but it's horrible. But they make a joke. I just love the joke that every time somebody asks Mickey Rourke's character why he's doing something weird or if he's doing something wrong, he's like, no, I'm from Brooklyn. Like, that's an explanation.
Yeah, like he even says that to the devil at one point. The devil asks him if he ever believed in God or if he's in it. He says, are you an atheist? And he says, I'm from Brooklyn. Instant answer. It's also worth noting that this movie was made in around 1987, which was a real high time for skepticism in our popular culture about organized religion, mm-hmm. with all the televangelists and stuff.
Yes. Yeah. But at the same time, it was this real weird period of our culture where there was all this nostalgia for like the 50s and very much tying into Reagan's Morning in America, like, America did have this golden age and now we've strayed from that. I mean, I was reading something when I was doing research on Angel Heart, this critic, Michael Dwyer, claimed that more than 90 Hollywood films were set in or represented or recreated the 50s or had a significant soundtrack of songs from the 50s or narrative allusions. And mm-hmm. that includes Angel Heart, but also like, you know, Blue Velvet and, you know, Peggy Sue Gets Married and all these other, and like Back to the Future. There were just constant reminders of like the past of America's glory. But the weird thing is, like, there was all this racial tension happening, and the way that we contained it in films was through these interracial buddy movies. And so there was this time of optimism. Like, we were putting forward this optimistic face. America is still strong. America's united, and like America of the 50s. But the very thin facade was that, oh, like, there's a black and white, you know, pairing in this film, and they're both united together against some foreign threat, or some like communist threat, or some un-American threat. But the way that these black characters were positioned were constantly like sidekicks or foils or, you know, background characters. So it's very easy to look at these movies and just pick this kind of optimism apart as, like, I mean, this is what we did with Cocktail as well, right? Like, just the very thinnest veneer of positivity about what was happening, and you just have to scratch it ever so slightly.
I think what's so clever about the structure of Angel Heart is that when we go watch a film noir, when we watch a detective film, we feel like we're the detectives a little bit while we're watching a movie. We're sort of trying to unravel the mystery along with the protagonist. But this is a movie that is ultimately about an unreliable narrator. Mm-hmm. The main character, Harry Angel, is basically looking for himself. And that was a big thing that happened a lot in that year, in 1987, in movies. Another movie that I love from that time that's kind of the same thing is No Way Out. I don't know if you ever saw that.
Kevin Costner movie, right?
Yeah. That's the movie where this mistress of this high-ranking government official is murdered, and he is put in charge of the investigation because he was also seeing this girl. And so he knows that the investigation is going to lead to himself, that he's been tasked with. But what we don't know, and we find out in the last few minutes of the movie, is that he's a Russian spy. And that's the real reason why he's trying to slow down the investigation, is because it's going to blow his cover. And at the end of the film, he is sequestered off to his Russian handler, and all of a sudden Costner's talking in Russian. And the entire theater gasped, because we did not see this coming. We thought we were watching this standard mystery where we think that the detective who's been tasked to find himself is being set up. But in fact, he's got an ulterior motive, which is revealed to us in the surprising last few minutes of the film. I did not see that one coming either.
I have to see it, because I want to see Kevin Costner speaking Russian or doing anything that's not in a conspicuously Texas accent. But that's really interesting then. If this was kind of a widespread thing where it's kind of like that meme, we're all looking for the guy who did this, like all the main characters are pointing at themselves, basically. I mean, that in itself is a very good mirror of the 80s, you know, like, how did we get to this point? Nobody knows, but oh, our entire history is kind of violent and leading up to this point. So.
Oh no, Robin, you've just destroyed my brain, because now I'm thinking the last few minutes of Angel Heart is Mickey Rourke saying, we're all looking for the guy who did this. Like Mickey Rourke dressed up as a hot dog talking to Robert De Niro.
That's my remake of the film. So.
I think you should go to hell. That's what it should be called. So let's go back to the plot. So what's going on in New Orleans? There's a memorable scene where he goes to Coney Island and talks to this couple that are at the water. And she basically, the woman standing in the water is the one who tells Rourke that he needs to go down to New Orleans to continue the search.
Yeah, but this is what I find so this is what I find interesting about this film, because in voodoo films in general and hoodoo films, they have to set themselves in a very kind of colonized place worldview. So if it's, you know, like internal colony of black communities in the South, or a lot of them are set in like the West Indies, or, you know, Haiti when it comes to Serpent and the Rainbow. So they set themselves in this kind of like black or African diasporic worldview, but they have to have kind of white protagonists. And so with this, they kind of have to surround themselves with other Black characters, but the Black characters are kind of like non-persons at the level of the plot. So even before he goes to Coney Island, he actually meets with one of Tootsweet's old band leaders, Spider, I believe.
Yeah, like Spider Simmons. Kind of
old, yeah, in this old folks' home. But what the film does is it doesn't let Spider narrate his own story. So we only hear his story as Mickey Rourke's character, as Harry Angel, is narrating it back to his little, the old school, like reel to reel, right? So he doesn't get to tell his old, his own story. And then the film jumps to Coney Island for this scene that I feel is mostly for, you know, comic relief or like just different scenery. And they basically reiterate most of that information. So Spider had already said cruise marks in New Orleans, Tootsweet. And he gets that same information from this couple, but they get to tell it kind of in their own words. And they have this quite extended scene. Mm-hmm. For me, like having those scenes so close together really illustrated that the movie's critical of some of these hierarchies, but it reiterates that same hierarchy in the structure of the film. Mm-hmm. So the characters that are Black and of color don't get to tell their own stories. We're seeing them through the lens of this unreliable narrator, yes, but also these random white characters to come in and give information that's essentially already been given. So he goes to New Orleans, and when he gets off of the train from New Orleans, there's this really interesting introduction to the city, which is he gets off the train and there's just like a kind of cut to these young Black boys and Black teens dancing in the street to bluesy, zydeco-y kind of music.
And they've got tap shoes.
Yeah. And there's a lot of intercutting, like it intercuts with him getting off the train, it intercuts with him putting his luggage away and it doesn't directly connect to anything. It's just setting up the scene that this is a different space and it's the touristy New Orleans space that you're used to. And you're going to see lots of gumbo and lots of crawfish and lots of jazz and dancing.
And real, and like, and a lot of the white people in all the New Orleans stuff are very portly guys, like fatties and stuff like that. Like, it's like your standard issue portrayal of Louisiana.
And they have like literally crawfish bibs on.
Yeah.
Rourke, just like out.
And Rourke even gets shoved into a crawfish, like there's a box with a bunch of crawfish in them that he gets thrown into and stuff like.
Yeah, all the signifiers. But he goes to New Orleans to find Cruise Mark and to find Evangeline Proudfoot. But we find out that she's passed away, but her daughter still lives. Oh, and I have a really interesting piece of trivia that I found out in my like 100th watch of this film. So he goes to a hoodoo shop.
Yes.
And he asks the woman about Evangeline and he's like, I'm a friend of hers. And this woman looks at him with the hardest side eye I've ever seen. She's like, And he tells this story and the other men in there are looking at him also askew. And what he goes in there to buy is High John root.
High John the Conqueror root.
High John the Conqueror root. And if you know the story of High John the Conqueror, he was a trickster.
Ah.
There's like these folk stories of him being a trickster. And I believe a former slave that outwitted people and kind of shape-shifted almost.
Yeah.
So that in itself is like this huge clue, this huge Easter egg that I did not catch the first time. He's there, like it's this microcosm of his own story and she gives it to him, but she gives him as least information as possible. But the difference is in this shop, they can't kick him out. Like in Harlem, he got out of line. They like escorted him violently out.
Yeah.
Even though everybody knows he's some type of law enforcement, and one older man gets up as if he's going to do something and then sits back down. This is a different, like the South is a different place. Like you can't attack a white man who might be part of law enforcement or private eye or anything, even though you know he's not there for the reason he says. Everybody's kind of walking on eggshells around him, just not being helpful, but not acting.
I noticed that last night too. It's funny you mention it, because at one point, like, he's trying to sort of butter her up a little bit, like, oh, just like the poem. And she goes, just like the poem. Like, she's getting this, she's like $1.20. Like, she just wants this to be over and to, for him to get the fuck out of her store. But yeah. But he doesn't have to be a white anything. Like, he doesn't have to be law enforcement. He's a white man. So, mm-hmm. you know, the law's on his side down in New Orleans, because, and there's also a telling moment where Rourke gets on the St. Charles streetcar. And he, Charlotte Rampling, and he's sitting in the colored section of the streetcar.
Yeah, there's, it's so interesting because they are constantly putting his character in these spaces. And I think it's like kind of for two reasons. One, I think it sets him up as a sympathetic character. So like he's supposed, he has like more progressive racial policies that, or politics that look familiar in the 80s, you know, like, so he helps a random black woman who loses her hat in the street. He has this very friendly meeting with Spider. He doesn't look uncomfortable when talking to people. Like he kind of mixes in and he sits in this colored section. And on one hand, you're like, oh, he's not this bad guy. He's not one of these very oppressive characters. But on the other hand, and like, this goes back to why I think people were critiquing it. It's this proximity to black spaces and this constant mixing, and the fact that he puts himself, that there is a trope that in black spaces, it encourages white protagonists to act badly or explore their desires, or it means that they're already somehow corrupted. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that all this happens and he's so comfortable being in that space, that's kind of set up an association between the two things.
Yeah. I mean, and he also has the hots for Lisa Bonet when he meets her, which we'll get into later. But he's very, I mean, there's also a seeming chemistry between the two of them. Like, they seem to like each other. He meets her because he goes to the town where Evangeline Proudfoot was buried. She died waiting for her man who never came. Johnny Favorite, but they had a daughter, and that's Epiphany Proudfoot. Another metaphor alert. Her name is Epiphany.
Yeah,
a word he can't pronounce either. At one point, he mangles her name. Rourke's character is always mangling people's names. Like, he refuses to call Louis Cipher his name. He keeps calling him Cyphier and Cyphiers. And stuff. And that's another tell too, because this whole movie is about the return of the repressed, which is a very important concept in horror. That this guy has basically rebuilt his own life, and he tried to cheat the devil, and he's basically convinced himself of his new identity, which may or may not be related to his war experiences. This entire movie is about him suddenly having, the jig is up with this character. Like, he is on this huge odyssey to discover who he is. And he does not want the answer. He gets it anyway.
Yeah, and I feel like that's where some of my discomfort came in the film, because there's this whole moral philosophy that you have to go through where the devil's clearly setting him up, and setting him up in a way that he has to, like, he's formed this new life because he's in this new body, or he's taken on the form of another body, I guess. Like, the mechanics of the switch are not entirely clear, but he like makes him go through all the institutions of like identity. He's like, all right, now like go to the newspapers, and then you're going to go like see birth certificates, and then you're going to go see where he lives, and then you're going to like, so he's forced to uncover his own identity. And what sometimes feels unfair is that he doesn't remember what he's done. And so in order for the devil to punish him or something, or collect on him, he has to make him remember his own sins. Like, which raises an interesting kind of point about Christianity. It's like, you know, if you can't remember your transgressions, are you really the, like, you know, quote unquote person who's committed them? Or do you get some grace because that's no longer in your recollection? And so it, at the end, I kind of felt like, well, he doesn't remember what he did at some point. Like, and there's some idea that he's been suppressing it, but he does seem truly surprised to find out that he's the one that's been murdering all these people, and that he's the one that's been running And whatever happened in the course of this body transfer gave him some type of amnesia.
Yeah. Is that related to his war, being shell-shocked in the war? Because he had to have facial, surgery. I'm a little fuzzy on the details of the not only the black magic ritual that I guess the Johnny favorite character was trying to cheat the Faustian pact that he'd made with the devil, that he mm-hmm. promised him stardom, but he basically swapped bodies with this yeah. soldier that he and the Kruzmarks found a young soldier in Times Square and lured him into a hotel where they sacrificed him, and he ate his heart and then turned into him. But then was he damaged in the war? That's the part that I'm a little fuzzy on, is why he couldn't remember any of this stuff. He had some kind of an injury. Did he go back to, did the Harry Angel character go back to World War II and get injured after the body switch? That's the part I'm a little confused by.
Yeah.
And I've seen the movie like 6 times.
I know. And I feel like I grasp it and then I lose it. It's like I figure it out and then I lose it. But I think what happened is he does the switch on another soldier that just came back. And then right after the switch, he gets drafted and he goes, and then right. he gets shell shocked. And that's why he forgets. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think it's just from eating a heart or something.
Yes. They don't really give you the details, but he basically like consumes the man's heart. And, mm-hmm. let's talk a little bit too about the repeating imagery in this movie. This is one of the things that I found so effective about this film. I think of Angel Heart, it wasn't a huge success. Like, it made its money back. It was a bigger hit in Europe, but it's sort of, now it's considered, along with movies like The Exorcist and Rosemary's mm-hmm. Baby, as like classic Hollywood sort of satanic horror.
Yeah. I think what's interesting to me and what's important to kind of look at in Alan Parker's career, like the arc of his career, was that before Angel Heart, he had done Birdie like a little bit before. And that film has a lot of like oniric, very like dreamlike, fantastical imagery. It's like a very different tone than we see in Angel Heart, but he's using that imagery to kind of address a difficult subject in that film. And it's mm-hmm. it's interesting to me that he goes kind of back to Angel Heart to use this like nightmarish imagery to a very different effect. Mm-hmm. If you compare it to Mississippi Burning and Come See the Paradise, or his other films are much more straightforward. So I think what I like about this movie is its messiness. Like, he has all these, you know, like the fans in the windows, and then the staircases, and all the beating hearts and stuff, like the heartbeats that kind of punctuate all these important moments in the film when he's lost time, or he's like about to lose time, which mm-hmm. I didn't notice when I first watched it.
Yeah.
But this is a story that has to be told this way, but it's also a story that to get to the times were surreal, and like the fact that the country was just coming out of war, the country was experiencing all this racial turmoil. I feel like in some ways, like surreality, fantastical, like kind of speculative films get to the truth of how insane and turbulent this post-war time was, more than just like, you know, a post-war film or like a melodrama or something. You really need some leaps to get the emotional gut punch that I think people were going through.
Let's review the main things that we keep seeing all the time in the movie. We keep seeing fans mm-hmm. turning, slowly or quickly turning. Mm-hmm. We keep seeing a woman, what we presume to be a woman in a black dress, sitting in a chair mm-hmm. holding a dish that has something yeah. in it. We keep seeing elevator shafts. Mm-hmm. You know, we keep seeing this, what is, I guess, the elevator to hell.
Yeah.
We keep seeing flashes of Times Square during World War II, which turns out to be where they found Harry Angel, the soldier for the sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And we keep seeing more and more of it. But the thing that really stunned me when I watched the movie again, now that I knew everything, was that those sequences are the placeholders for Harry Angel murdering people.
Mm-hmm.
And what really freaked me out, actually, this time when I was watching it, is that I recognized that a lot of the screaming that we hear throughout these sequences is the sounds of his victims dying, which we also hear before those sequences. Like, we can hear Lisa Bonet screaming in, like, the first 45 minutes of the movie before we've even met her character yet.
Oh.
That was something that occurred to me. Is, like, because this is, because it's almost like the film is being presented to us almost as if it was made by the devil. Like, there's something so supernatural about all those sequences. But it's really, really disturbing. And the movie also has very muted colors, except the color red is almost always very vibrant and very, very strong. We also see a repeating image of what we also think is a woman wiping the blood off a wall. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we even see that at the very beginning of the film. When Rourke goes to the church in Harlem, we can see what appears to be a woman wiping off the blood from a wall, and they just casually say, oh, a parishioner killed himself in there a couple of minutes ago, or something like that.
Yeah, it was quite bizarre how casually that came out. I'm like, oh, this isn't good. Like, that's your first sign that something's wrong.
But we also see that happening in the hotel room where the sacrifice took place. Like, there are all these things that you would think that the Mickey Rourke character would remember, that, you know, we're seeing the movie the way he's seeing it, except he's seeing it because he's repressed all these memories, mm-hmm. whereas we don't know what we're seeing. We're piecing it together.
Yeah, you know, the whole thing about hearing Lisa Bonet's character get murdered before it happens, I definitely didn't piece together, but it also raises this disturbing question of free will, right? Mm-hmm. Because if these things are being hinted at even beforehand, it's like you have to wonder how much the devil knows. Like, is this like a foregone conclusion that at the end of the day, he's going to remember who he is? Like, is there any way that this could have gone differently? Or at the end, you know, like, can you just, I mean, I guess maybe that's the point of the movie. You're not going to fool the devil. you're not going to be able to get out of a Faustian bargain. He is a fallen angel.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, there's no way out of this. Once he agrees to meet with Louis Cipher, it seems like it's a foregone conclusion.
Yeah. And he tries to get out of it early on, and then the devil just ups his fee to an astronomical level. Like, he offers him $5,000, which in like the mid 50s would have been like offering you $200,000. You know, it's like,
yeah,
how could you say no? But like, for instance, in that scene at the beginning where he meets the doctor who, you know, was pretending that, that the man was still in the mental institution, or was mm-hmm. in the, what is it? Was he convalescing?
It was
in a home injured people, or injured war. I couldn't remember whether it was for war veterans or just people who are incapacitated. But he goes to visit the doctor and gets the information out of him by withholding his morphine because he has mm-hmm. an addiction. And then he locks him in his bedroom and then goes. And then we see the first of these weird flashbacks where we see, the woman in the black dress and a mm-hmm. church, and we hear scary organ music. And then he goes to a cafe, has a coffee, and then goes back to the house and discovers the doctor's dead. But he locked the door.
Like, yeah.
So it's him. But we don't put that together in the first time we're watching the movie. But at the end, it's like, oh my God. Like, so he's committing these crimes, but he has no memory of them either. But this is the unreliable narrator. In a way, it's Harry Angel, but also in another way, it's Alan Parker. He's withholding information from us. And like The Sixth Sense, this movie has everything riding on the big payoff at the end. Like, if the big payoff doesn't work, then the movie is stupid, you know?
But clearly it worked, because neither of us put it together. And even though you see him lock it, I mean, I didn't put it together in that scene. I just thought, as the film went on, I was like, wow, it's the devil.
Yeah.
Or you figure out it's the devil. So I just thought the devil was like kind of magically getting into these spaces when Harry Angel left. But I definitely didn't put two and two until I did start to to wonder, ironically, when the two racist New Orleans cops came to visit him. Mm-hmm. And kind of, you know, in my research about Angel Heart, I think it's interesting because you can see so much more starkly like the necropolitics of the South when it comes to how race delimits and like frames everything the characters do in that movie. Everything is kind of framed by the segregation. And so the cops and the ability of the police or the government to make life unlivable for this incomplete segment of the population. Mm-hmm. And as you see, like Epiphany does live in squalor, like they live in shacks, they don't have running water. Mm-hmm. It looks like a different colonial space. But when the cops come to him and they talk very casually about Tutsweet's death,
yes,
and he dies in this super brutal way, which is very akin to lynching, like his genitals are cut off and stuffed in his mouth, and they're kind of like, yeah, he died, but these voodoo people off each other all the time. And they come back to him when Cruz Mark dies. So the fact that they came to him twice and they seemed to piece something together, that was the only part of the movie that I was like, like, I wonder what they have, you know, like, because I hadn't suspected him at all to this point, but because the cops are such terrible people,
yeah,
you kind of put that away because you're like, oh, these bigots, you know, like yeah. They don't have anything. But yeah, they were actually onto something.
Yeah. And they're being racist too. The mm-hmm. cops are being openly racist because they're also mad at Rourke because he's got a black girl in his hotel room, which mm-hmm. is a no-no in 1955 for racist cops in New Orleans. The thing that I was wondering about was the girl dead in the hotel room and the cops didn't know it? Because this whole conversation takes place on the balcony when they go visit Rourke. This scene takes place right after the sex scene.
Yeah, you're right. The timeline's so difficult to piece together because he leaves and then he doesn't like quote unquote discover her until he comes back. But that's probably right.
Well, he's talking, he talks to the cops and then he goes back in to the hotel room and she's having a bath and she's singing that song, Girl of My Dreams, that 30s song that was the big hit for Johnny Favorite. That the brilliant soundtrack in this movie interpolates, like the entire score is based on that old 78.
Mm-hmm.
Like we keep hearing that refrain, but he seems kind of upset with her that she's singing that song in the bathtub and he's looking at himself in a shattered mirror. And then that's the end of the scene. And to me, I was wondering when I was watching it after now knowing everything that happened is like, was that scene real? Was that the moment that he decided to kill her? I was very confused by that moment, like because everything's breaking down at this point in the film. Like we don't know what's real and what's not real by the end.
No, we don't. And for me, I always wondered if she actually knew. It seemed to me that Epiphany had some idea of who he was, which raises the big question. Wait, are we spoiling it yet? Or can we
please
talk about this yet?
Yeah.
So
my listeners have had 34 years to watch this movie.
Spoiler alert. Epiphany is Evangeline and Johnny Favorite's daughter. Very much in the tradition of like femme fatales and tragic mulatto characters. She is tragic and Johnny Favorite is Harry Angel. Harry Angel is Johnny Favorite. So essentially she's sleeping with her father. Mm-hmm. And she definitely drops a lot of clues that she kind of knows who Harry Angel is, like why he's there. And when she was singing that song in the bathtub, I was kind of like, okay, this is her dad's song. But also, I don't know, she just seemed to know a bit more than he did. She always seemed to be like one step ahead. So I'm not sure, you know. Well, you know,
and even more disturbing, she had a baby by a man that she didn't know who he was, who it turns out to be Satan. Robert De Niro is the baby's father. as we see in the crudely I wouldn't even call it CGI, as is confirmed in the very crude optical effect eyeball stuff, which is one of the things that does not work in Angel Heart. As good as the movie is and as effective as it is, it's pretty cheesy at the end when their eyes are glowing.
Yeah, and then like the baby, the baby's pointing at him too, like the baby's like accusing. I know.
And you can see that the head's been stuck on optically on the shot. It didn't look good in 1987, and it doesn't look good today. To me, it's like the only real brown note in the movie. Like, you could have cut that out. It might have still been effective.
Yeah, and I don't even know what the whole point was of having her have the devil's baby. You know, like, why did that need to be part of it? I mean, just so we know that she's into some, like, freaky stuff. Was it just, like, an indictment of, like, voodoo and kind of that ritual? I'm not really sure. It seemed so extra, and then it didn't work on top of it, so they definitely didn't need it.
But I got to tell you, you could hear a pin drop in the theater in the last 15 or 20 minutes of the movie. The audience was just supremely shocked by the end of the movie when Harry Angel gets an exposition dump by Cruz Mark's father, who explains everything. And then Harry Angel runs back to Margaret Cruz Mark's salon where she was doing fortune telling and busts open a vase that was sealed that had the dog tags of the soldier that they had sacrificed. And we see the name is Harry Angel and that, and we hear Mickey Rourke saying, "Oh no, oh no." And then we see Robert De Niro with his hair down now reappear as the devil. And then in the last few minutes of the movie, after Rourke has a very, very powerful scene where he's self-destructing, like that didn't seem like acting. That seemed like Mickey Rourke had a nervous breakdown and they filmed it. Like, it's very, very effective. Like, it just feels like, and we kind of like this person as gross as he is. He's a friendly guy. Like, he's joking around with people, but we find out that Johnny Favorite is like an incredibly horrible person. Like, as this character has reinvented himself and turned into a different person, you could argue that he's turned into a better person, but that entire facade is shattered and destroyed. And at the end of the movie, he goes back to his hotel and finds the cops there with the corpse of Lisa Bonet in a really grisly tableau. And then he says, the cops say to him, "Do you know this girl?" And he says, "That's my daughter." And the whole theater was like, "Oh God." Everyone in the room was just because they have a very, very explicit sex scene. And we'll get into the controversy at the time in a couple of minutes. But like, you know, it's just, it's got everything, this movie. It's got human sacrifice. It's got
incest.
It's got Satan. It's got a deal with the devil. It's got
a little bit of cannibalism.
Being pulled out of chests. Like I find that like, horror of today doesn't quite go as far as Angel Heart went in terms of just making you feel ill while you're watching this movie.
No, and it's because they try to go about it in cheap ways. I feel like, you know, it's what I find horror doing nowadays is they're like, "Oh, we got to show people that this person's a monster and the stakes are high. We're going to kill a baby." And it just like, it goes from like 0 to 60. And, you know, it's a very lazy way of disturbing people and showing that there are stakes. And I feel like Angel Heart does everything very methodically and step by step. And the kind of pulling away of reality, like, you know, the tearing away of the fabric of reality is what makes it so disturbing and is what makes it stick with you. And also the thing that De Niro said that was super chilling is when Rourke is crying and he's like, "I know who I am." It's such an iconic line. "I know who I am." And he's like, "No matter how fast you like run past a mirror, you always see yourself," you know? So this idea that he was always in some way like seeing that soldier and doing this, you know, intense repression, like it goes back to the free will question for me. Like, you know, is there a possibility of change? If you change, but you've done these horrible things, is there redemption? No. doesn't seem so.
"How terrible is wisdom when it brings no profit to the wise, Johnny."
"Louis Cipher, Lucifer. Even your name is a dime store joke.
Mephistopheles is such a mouthful in Manhattan, Johnny.
You think posing as the devil is because it scared some superstitious old guitar player and that witch and that nutty old man? You think it's gonna scare me? It ain't. I know who I am. And you killed them. And you're trying to pin it on me. You're trying to frame me. Cypher, I know who I am. You murdered them people. I never killed nobody. I didn't kill Fowler. And I didn't kill Toots. And I didn't kill Margaret. And I didn't kill Cruzmark. I didn't kill no one.
I'm afraid you did, Johnny.
My name's not Johnny.
All killed by your own hand, guided by me, naturally. Frankly, you were doomed from the moment you slit that young boy in half, Johnny. For 12 years, you've been living on borrowed time and another man's memories.
This is one of the things that scares the shit out of me when I watch horror movies, is the idea of you not having your own will. That's mm-hmm. what's so effective about Cure, the Kurosawa film.
Yes, yes.
Is like the I mean, I got to do an episode on that movie, but suffice it to say, like, this guy is basically turning people into murderous automatons, right? Mm-hmm. Like, through his sheer will. And this is what the devil does in Angel Heart. He tells him that he killed all these people by my, you know, with help from me. Mm-hmm. Like, he basically, like, because he owns his soul. He doesn't mm-hmm. have a soul, actually. He owns him.
Yeah.
And he is a very vengeful devil. Like, he plays with his prey before he kills him. You can see throughout the movie, once you have full understanding of the story, that when Rourke is saying, "I'm a murder suspect now," the devil's like, interesting. You know, like, he's like, he's being like a total prick.
He looks permanently amused.
Yeah.
Like, even when they first meet, and Harry's like, you know, I went to the war myself. I know a little bit about something myself. And the devil's like, is that right?
Yeah.
You know, and he's completely like this look of smug amusement on his face. And yeah. you just know that he's really enjoying it.
Yeah.
And I mean, he used Harry to get rid of anybody who could have possibly corroborated or supported Johnny Favorite's side of that mm-hmm. particular story. Mm-hmm. There's also something interesting here that I don't know enough about to study, but or to really speak on. But Johnny Favorite was a crooner, and there has been a lot of research about how and his name is Liebling, and you know, they're living in Coney Island in Brooklyn, and there was a lot of research about how, you know, in early entertainment, like, entertainers of Jewish background would change their names
yes.
to become household names. Mm-hmm. And there's some connection. I mean, and you see it in minstrel shows as well. But, you know, also the appropriation of blackness in order to get famous. And Johnny Crooner, Johnny Favorite was a crooner, but then he worked with this black band.
Yeah.
So there's something there that needs to be teased out by somebody that knows more about that history than myself. But I thought the fact that they kept mentioning, like, he had kind of changed his name and he had changed his background, and then he had kind of lost himself in this community of more visible outsiders, was really interesting to me.
I want to just loop back around to something that our talk before we did this recording, we were talking about thing that you're writing right now about mm-hmm. Angel Heart and the connection between racial necropolitics. Mm-hmm. And I watched the movie with this in mind, but can you tell us a little bit about this concept for my listeners? Because it's very interesting.
Yeah. So, I mean, Michel Foucault and Agamben talk a little bit about biopower and, like, power that the state has to over, like, to shape people's actual biological life. And the scholar Achilles Membe, he kind of took this to its logical extension, and he talked about how these biopolitics nowadays are being used to subjugate and mark certain populations for death, right?
Yeah.
So I think this is a pretty close paraphrasing. It's just when certain populations are subjected to conditions that make them the living dead. So this is social death. This is genocide. This is, you know, civil death, which means you are a legal non-person. So some of the ways that we treat refugees or people in Guantanamo would fit this kind of, you know, not physical death, but, you know, if you're not recognized by any state, if you're in like this type of political, civil, social limbo, then you are essentially like, you know, both living and dead. Like your death will not be noticed or you know, you're outside the legal system as well. So, but the other part of this is that certain populations are marked this way and so that other populations can thrive. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the, you know, in the 50s with segregation, arguably necropolitics was, you know, being enacted all over the country. And I think we kind of like fool ourselves when we think it was a lot better in the North. If you've ever been to Boston, you know, it's not better in the North. But my family's from New Orleans and a little town called Church Point in Louisiana. And Louisiana in particular is a very interesting, has a very interesting racial history, because when that police officer says, "We don't do that here," it's the funniest thing ever. If you know the history of New Orleans, where it is, there was so much, you know, racial, like interracial mixing. And, you know, this was the place where kind of the gradations of color, you know, really meant something. If you were like eighth and half and a quarter, and, you know, passing was, something that people didn't necessarily try to do. But when you go to New Orleans, even in my own family, there's people that, you know, have blonde hair and blue eyes. And there's people that have, you know, very dark brown skin and very dark hair, because there was an incredible amount of like Spanish, French, other interracial mixing. I think Brazil might be like a very close analog, particularly there. So this mixing was happening. So the fact that they have this in the script was very funny. But certainly, you know, the way that Epiphany was living in the film, where she's like washing her hair under an outside faucet and, you know, people are walking around without shoes. There's a very strict limit on what Black people and people of color could accomplish in New Orleans at this time. And when the police say, "Oh, these voodoo people off each other all the time," it's kind of like he's saying the quiet part loud. Like, you know, this is a non-person. We don't care. Mm-hmm. Cruz-a-Mark is old white money. Now we care.
Yes. Yeah. That's very explicitly stated in the film. But here are the two things that when you were talking about necropolitics that I was thinking about in this movie. First of all, the idea of being the walking dead and being alive and dead at the same time is Harry Angel. Mm-hmm. And the movie is about a living man discovering that he's actually dead. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like a man who thinks that he's a one kind of person finds out he's actually the worst possible kind of person. He's a multiple murderer. He's committed human sacrifice. He's committed incest. And he's going to hell. And I also was thinking about racial necropolitics in the sense of the cavalier way in which the cops find the body of Lisa Bonet, which is very, very, I'm not even going to describe it. You can watch the movie for yourself.
Right.
But the way that the cops sort of dismiss her as just being, you know, another, you know, dead Black girl, the idea of certain lives having value and certain lives not having value is an American problem. Mm-hmm. And it repeated itself in New Orleans when Hurricane Katrina happened.
Absolutely.
I can't think of another American city that would be allowed to be sacrificed the way that New Orleans was in Katrina.
Yeah, no, I mean, exactly. Those people, the government basically marked those people for death. And even the way the media reported on, you know, conditions in the camp and like the camps and like, you know, that people were, there was just constant reports on how much crime was happening. And there was, until it was over, you couldn't find a lot of in-depth articles about how the community had been failed, you know, structurally. I mean, literally, like the actual kind of physical infrastructure of the city. Mm-hmm. But there's even stuff coming out now, which is very interesting, about kind of the extrajudicial killings that were happening from people in white neighborhoods.
Yes.
Where like Black New Orleans residents were coming in because, you know, they needed food and they were, you know, walking around and trying to get help. And people were shooting for people. And there were plenty of reports at the time, and they just kind of like sat on those reports because it seemed too horrible to believe. And now a lot of that stuff is being substantiated. There were these like militias. And I think it's, New Orleans is a beautiful place, but I don't think anybody super familiar with the city is incredibly surprised by kind of that level of racial violence that happened.
And yeah, and just the idea that you could lose so many people in the city and life goes on. Like, yeah. I can't imagine New York City being flooded the way that New Orleans got flooded, and it not being the top story in the country for years.
Yeah.
Just like September 11th. But when New Orleans got just destroyed by Katrina, not the first time either. Mm-hmm. New Orleans was devastated in the 1927 floods.
Yeah.
But here it is happening all over again. And I know that Alan Parker wasn't presaging anything when he made Angel Heart, but I think that it was very interesting for him to, for whatever motivated him, to stage this horrible Faustian story about the value of human life in New Orleans.
Yeah, no, I'm struck by that too. And what makes it even more interesting is that he's like British. So, I mean, I guess, you know, it's not a uniquely American problem, but the particular type of racism that comes out of like chattel slavery, which in itself is like a complete dehumanizing of a person because their literal property is particular to like the States and maybe a couple of other plantation slavery locales. But he did a lot, like he did a surprising amount of films set in very multicultural spaces. Like he did Fame, you know, he did this film, he did Mississippi Burning. I guess the one critique would be like all of these movies still have like mostly white protagonists, even though they're set in these diverse spaces. He did Come See the Paradise, which is not a great film, but it did cover very important like Japanese internment. So even though he wasn't from North America, he had a pretty interesting understanding of how race and class worked here.
Yeah.
And even The Commitments, I feel like, draws on, like, I guess a specifically Irish or UK concept of class, but how working class get racialized in some ways over there.
And how the Irish get racialized in the United Kingdom. I mean, maybe that's what Parker, and the whole idea of the authenticity of Irish people playing rhythm and blues and soul music too, which is another tradition.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I mean, we won't talk about Van Morrison too much here, but, but The Commitments is very much about that, right? Like the band that want to do R&B, who are all these Irish kids, they feel persecuted in the UK the way that, you know, young Black kids would feel persecuted in America.
Yeah. There's some kinship there where they, you know, they like gravitate towards the music of another outsider. And interestingly, like, I mean, you see that quite a bit, like even in post-war Japan, particularly in the post-war period, you know, there were all these 60s films about Black soldiers and Japanese teenagers, like being super into jazz and stuff because, you know, they felt like outsiders and they wanted to be part of an outsider culture. Mm-hmm. It was a very like facile comparison. Read my dissertation if you want to know more about it. But it's interesting. It's interesting how, you know, Black American culture becomes this kind of general outsider safe space for a lot of other groups.
Yeah. I think like Angel Heart, for a white filmmaker to be telling this story that is sort of set in a Black environment and a white, you know, the white perspective on the Black environment, I wouldn't say that it is simply that I wouldn't call racist this movie, you know, even though it plays around with some stuff that's troubling.
I don't think so either, but I certainly see why some people say that because of that proximity I talk about, mm-hmm. and why, you know, like when he's in those spaces, bad things happen. And I think like also the portrayal of voodoo was was really stupid in this film and quite muddled. So that particular folk religion wasn't respected. But I do think, you know, as I said, every white character in this film is really despicable and has, like, you know, the seven mortal sins, you know, like each one of them, you can pull out, like, lust, greed, sloth, you know, gluttony. There's some sense that America, like post-war America, really overreached, like in that overreach, like in the micro is like him trying to fool the devil himself by, like, you know, taking ownership of another body. And of course, you know, taking ownership of another body, you get into these metaphorical situations where, you know, lost control over your own bodily autonomy itself gestures towards American history, right? So,
yeah. One thing I want to say too, I think that, you know, even though I wouldn't say that this movie's racist, I think that there was a racial component to the way that the ratings board treated this film.
Yeah, absolutely.
What they were really upset about was this incredibly graphic sex scene involving one of the Cosby kids, you know, and the idea of interracial, like, it's a very, very graphic sex scene. It's got... I mean, you know, see, if you haven't seen it, you should see it. Cause it's also like a really, that's where the montage really intensifies in this film, where we see even more of the story behind this movie. It's raining. The water is getting into the hotel room and then water turns into blood. Like, there's water dripping down from the ceiling, but it eventually becomes a torrent of blood.
Yeah. And it's a really rough sex scene as well. And it's not youth or the roughness of the sex scene. Cause, like, I feel like we were discussing this earlier, but in films of the '70s and the '80s, it wasn't super unusual to see, you know, female characters that were 16 or pretty young being sexualized in a very obvious way. Mm-hmm. And I think if Lisa Bonet were, Robin Givens, you know, like at the time, and she was, you know, a more, like, visibly, like, a darker skinned black woman, like, this wouldn't have flown at all. Like, they would have cut the vast majority of that scene out. So I think it's also, you know, we knew her, she was a Cosby kid, but also, you know, she's very clearly racially mixed as well. So it makes it a little bit more acceptable, but they would have not gone as hard on it if it were just a 17-year-old white ingenue, for sure.
You know, and this was made at a time where everybody thought that Bill Cosby was a wonderful person. Bill Cosby, by the way, played the devil in a movie too.
Did he?
Yeah, there's a movie called The Devil and Max Devlin, which I saw in a theater actually as a kid because I used to see everything, with Elliot Gould, and Bill Cosby plays the devil in that movie. So, sort of, as it turned out, it was typecasting, but
yeah, I mean, when you look up how upset he was at, like, Lisa Bonet's behavior, you know, like her on and her, you know, film roles, but then her offset behavior, where she was, like, you know, pregnant very young and dating, like, a rock star very young. She really wasn't an it girl. Lisa Bonet should have had a bigger career.
I know. This was a movie that people were talking about a lot at the time, not only because of the ratings controversy, but because it was Denise Huxtable having sex with Mickey Rourke. The film got the X rating.
Yeah.
Very, very, very heavy-handed treatment by the MPAA. Mm-hmm. The decision was upheld in an appeal. So Alan Parker wound up trimming 10 seconds out of the sex scene. And then it got reclassified as an R.
I wonder what the 10 seconds were.
Well, the full version is what came out on video. So the theatrical just has, like, 10 less seconds of Mickey Rourke's ass, basically. Okay.
Oh, that's too bad for those people.
I know. This was back when you wanted to see Mickey Rourke's ass, like the mid-80s. But it was just, it just gives you an idea of the heavy-handedness of the ratings board at that time. It was like, take 10 seconds out. The evil thing about how the MPAA used to operate is that they would tell you that you have to make cuts, but they wouldn't tell you what to cut.
Yeah. But isn't that how some people trick them? Like, isn't that,
yes,
are there, like, stories? That. Yeah, like the stories where they're like, sure, we'll cut it. And then they cut, like, 2 seconds or something.
De Palma kept resubmitting Scarface, having removed some stuff. And he kept being told, you have to take out more. And he even had an appeal where he actually talked to, like, all the people on the ratings board, and De Palma brought with him a DEA official, and he brought with him a priest. You know, he brought all these people with him to sort of argue as to why this, it's okay to show the violence that he shows in the movie. The MPAA still said no. So De Palma just put everything back and then rewrote the footage count to be lower, and they passed it.
Oh, hilarious.
So he just tricked them because he knew they weren't actually going to string up the movie and count every foot of the film. He just said, here you go.
But when you look, like, the 80s were like the decade of erotic thrillers. And I mean, RoboCop, it's like insanely violent, you know? I mean, just...
I know. Things were very hot and heavy in the multiplex in the mid-80s. I long for that kind of sleaze to return.
I know. And yes, there's been so much talk about how, like, films aren't sexy. Like, everybody, like, all the actors look super sexy, but nobody's allowed to be sexy, and there's no sexiness in the films themselves, which is a very interesting development in cinema.
One other funny thing I want to tell you about this film, when it was released, so they put it out on in the theaters as the R-rated cut. Toronto got that cut. The only city in North America that showed the complete uncut version of Angel Heart was Montreal. And in Quebec, not only did they get the uncut version, but it got rated PG-13 in Quebec. The cut that got the X in the States got a PG-13 in Quebec.
I wonder if they used it for some intense Jesus camp, like, teachings, where they were just like, look, this is what will happen to you when you stray from God. I have no idea how that would be PG-13 otherwise, honestly.
No, it's so bloody. Just for the bloodbath in this movie alone, and the N-word is used, you know, like, why would you say that's PG-13? Vive le Quebec Libre,
I suppose. I mean, this is the great kind of paradox of Catholicism, though. I think you can, a lot of stuff is excused if it's put within a kind of Christian moral framework. I mean, if you watch, like, Passion of the Christ, it's so graphic. And I mean, and we were talking about Midnight Mass, the new TV show by Mike Flanagan, and how that explores some of this. And it's really kind of gory to watch as well. And it talks through some very deep things. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, as long as it's in this moral framework, where he does get punished. I mean, that's what you need to ask for, you know, like, he did bad things, he got punished. And so maybe it's all okay to show all the bad things he did along the way.
I want to talk a little bit more about Bill Cosby, just a little bit more.
Oh man.
She got permission, quote unquote, from Cosby to make Angel Heart. But once it came out, this is a quote from Cosby. He said that it was a movie made by white America that cast a black girl, gave her voodoo things to do and have sex.
Yeah.
And then they asked him if he'd seen the film. He said he hadn't. And he also said, it doesn't offer my appetite anything.
Not enough drugs, I guess.
I know. It's like...
No, he had the audacity. I mean, you know, Bill Cosby went on that whole kind of moral high ground, pull up your pants tour in the 90s and was just lecturing, you know, young black people about what we should do and how, what music we should listen to and how to conduct ourselves.
How to speak properly.
Oh God. You know, and I think it was Richard Pryor's like ex-wife that was saying that you know, Richard knew the entire time, like what kind of man Bill Cosby was. And like, you know, you can be profane, but not be doing horrible things. Mm-hmm. And you can be super quote unquote clean and then have like, you know, this legacy of abusing women behind you like he did. So he has some audacity. I'll give that to him.
Major.
Speaking about this. Yeah.
And he fired Lisa Bonet from A Different World. Angel Heart came out a few months before A Different World hit the air, the spinoff of The Cosby Show. But she only lasted for the first season. She got pregnant and he fired her from the show. And he said, Lisa Bonet can get pregnant, but Denise Huxtable cannot get pregnant.
Yeah. I mean, that just wouldn't fly nowadays. It's amazing. But that show was still great. I mean, she should have been kept on the show. I like Denise Huxtable, but the show still worked really well, but that's very disgusting.
I read a recent interview with Lisa Bonet where she said that there was a real dark energy around Bill Cosby that she didn't really quite understand when they were working together. She saw glimpses of it the way that he was so vengeful about her and sort of sidelining her career. She didn't really do a lot of movies after she left A Different World. I guess she was mom to Zoe Kravitz.
Yeah. And I think it could have been a launch for her career, but I think, this goes back to her being a biracial black woman. There just wasn't a lot of space for, like, as a sex symbol, mm-hmm. as like a, you know, everybody thought Lisa Bonet was like incredibly good looking. And people still do. She's like a stunning person. But back in the 80s, there really wasn't a place to go, you know, if you wanted to be like a leading love interest in a film. And she wasn't considered, I guess, quote unquote, respectable enough after, you know, the performance in Angel Heart to really be put in other places. So I think it was going to be hard for her no matter what. I don't think she necessarily would have had a better chance with another film being her debut. Mm-hmm. But I think that one made it particularly tricky. And the dispute with Bill Cosby made it super tricky for her to get anything else.
But, you know, I have to hand it to the people that made this movie, including Rourke and including Lisa Bonet. This is a very challenging and difficult film and very risky. Like, for Lisa Bonet to decide to launch a possible Hollywood career by making Angel Heart mm-hmm. is very, very ballsy and risky decision on her part. I'm sorry it didn't break the right way for her.
Yeah, me too. Because I mean, I think she had charisma. She could have had a really interesting career. And I think her later work, like some of her stuff in High Fidelity,
yes,
hint at that. I think we definitely lost out. And of course, some of the stuff that her daughter is now doing. Mm-hmm.
I know. I was saying to you that I was looking at some comments on Twitter about Angel Heart, and I felt old immediately when someone said, oh yeah, that's the movie with Zoe Kravitz's mom in it.
The disrespect.
I know,
honestly.
She was like 18 or 19. Like, yeah. Come on, must you throw dirt in my face?
Yeah. Yes, they really must.
Angel Heart also is a very influential movie. I read that Christopher Nolan said that he has gotten a lot of inspiration about narrative structure and editing, especially in Memento on Angel Heart.
That makes sense. Like I think it's a real masterclass. And as you said, withholding information, like how directors can choose to, you know, withhold and kind of deflect from narrative information from their audience in order mm-hmm. to kind of set up this big reveal, because a lot of movies try to do it now and aren't good at it. Parker had a very strong handle on the tone and the story is difficult and it's dreamlike and it's you can't piece it together, but it's not nonsensical.
No.
It doesn't kind of take the easy way out and just become completely, you know, random and like rubber reality. You still have an idea of what he's going for and like what the characters are doing and where they are in time and space. And what I see now, especially like, you know, you're pre-screening for film festivals, a lot of people try to do something similar, particularly with stories about trauma, where they make it, you know, very disjunctive and, you know, people are kind of pulling across, like they're pulling threads of reality because they don't know what's happening to them and they don't understand it, but yeah. It ends up completely not making sense. So there's a way that you can kind of have a handle on it so that you can gesture to kind of the randomness of events and reality without completely losing the thread, but it's hard.
I want to say one more hilarious thing about this movie is this was the movie that began the feud between Mickey Rourke and Robert De Niro. One of my favorite feuds. They did not get along on the set. He went up to De Niro on the set and tried to strike up a conversation with him because he admired him, obviously. Mm-hmm. And De Niro just said to him, "I think it's better if we don't talk."
Ooh.
And so all their scenes together have a sort of a little bit of tension because they, you know, the it works for the movie. They don't like each other very much.
Maybe that's why De Niro did it, though. Like, you know, yeah. I choose to believe that De Niro's not super prickly on set. I don't know if that's true. Somebody on social media, I can't remember who it was, but was talking about Mickey Rourke and said, if this was you, I'm going to feel so embarrassed, and said that Mickey Rourke would have made a better Max Cady in the Cape Fear remake. And at first I was like, wow, how dare you, honestly. It's like, how dare you talk about De Niro that way? But then I started thinking about it, and I'm like, you know what? The kind of sleazy sex appeal that Mickey Rourke has might have actually made more sense in that role, because Robert Mitchum also had it, you know, like this sense of danger, but like this attractiveness. And so like, that's what they share. And Robert De Niro wasn't working that angle in his version, which I love that film with him in it, but I can definitely see how Mickey Rourke's energy would have been amazing in that role.
Well, it's funny you should mention, because Mickey Rourke in 2019 went on Italian television and alleged that Scorsese wanted him for a role in The Irishman, but it got kiboshed because De Niro refused to work with him.
Oh, no.
And the producers of The Irishman, including De Niro's business partner, Jane Rosenthal, said that Rourke was never in consideration for a role in the movie. But Rourke insists that he was. And then one fine day on Instagram, by the way, Mickey Rourke's pretty funny on Instagram, Rourke put this post up, which he has now deleted, but I want to read it to you because it's so funny. He wrote, "Hey, Robert De Niro. That's right. I'm talking to you, you big fucking crybaby." A friend of mine just recently told me that a few months back, you're quoted as saying to newspapers, "Mickey Rourke's a liar. He talks all kinds of shit." Listen, Mr. Tough Guy in the movies, you're the first person who ever called me a liar, and it was in a newspaper. Let me tell you something, you punk ass. When I see you, I swear to God, on my grandmother, on my brother, and all my dogs, I'm going to embarrass you severally, 100%. He wrote severally.
Wow. In front of the dogs.
On my grandmother, on my brother, and all my dogs. He added in the comments, "I'll be relocating, moving back to New York City in the next few months. This encounter will for sure happen."
Oh my goodness.
So Rourke has been maintaining this 30 plus year feud with Robert De Niro. And I guess it started with Angel Heart.
They're just really method acting, just carrying it all the way.
The battle of the method stars. What else is there to say about Angel Heart? Was there anything else you wanted to say?
Well, I guess the only thing I would say is that I feel like the Angel Heart kind of set the tone for these type of hoodoo films. And I think some of the racial political messiness about Angel Heart, which I do love, I think was addressed again in The Skeleton Key, which I think is a movie that's unfairly maligned. I really like The Skeleton Key. It's very flawed, but some of the issues with, you know, the Black characters not really using voodoo to their own benefit, and like not really having any agency, being non-persons in the film. Skeleton Key actually does interesting things with, and they become much more specific about the folk religion as well. So I think, you know, for some of Angel Heart's flaws, people saw that and then, you know, tried to rectify it in the narrative. Ultimately, The Skeleton Key and all the other hoodoo films set in the South that followed don't do it as artfully as Alan Parker did. But I think it did something very valuable to this particular subgenre.
I think that it has aged to be a movie that you can consider along with The Exorcist and with Rosemary's Baby. It's sort of aged into its classic status. It wasn't really a classic in 1987, the way The Exorcist was in its time.
It totally has. And I've really enjoyed seeing it kind of have this cult revival, and like this, you know, people are looking at it again and reviewing what was said about it earlier. And now it is considered as somewhat the classic that it's always been. And I read a really good piece on it from Walter Cha, and he called it a rich text. And I think that's exactly right. There's so much going on in Angel Heart that I think it confounded people at the time. But, you know, when you're not in that era, when you have a little bit of distance from the 80s and all of the weird stuff that was going on, I think we're able to look at it and see it for the kind of artistic work that it was.
Yeah, I can't source the quote, but I do remember reading that John Huston said that he thought the ending of Angel Heart was kind of stupid, but before it ended, he thought it was one of the best movies he'd ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
Like
he and if
was,
John Huston said
and
it.
And so if John Huston says it, that's good enough for me. But yeah, he said it was just superior filmmaking until the clumsy ending.
Yeah, but it's because of the baby eyes.
Yeah.
It's the baby eyes, yeah.
Don't put devil eyes on a baby.
No, don't even put devil eyes on Michael Jackson.
It is like the ending of the Thriller video.
They couldn't get contacts in a baby.
All it needed was Vincent Price laughing at the end as Mickey Rourke's going down the elevator to hell. Robin, this was so much fun. And I encourage my listeners, if you haven't seen Angel Heart and you still listen to this, you should watch it. I don't think we could possibly spoil this movie because it's style over substance, but what style?
Yeah, and also if you like Angel Heart, you should check out Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, which I think is also a rich text. Eve's Bayou, which is almost a perfect film and told from the perspective of people in the community, right?
Yes.
And then The Skeleton Key, which I think is Kate Hudson's best performance. Don't at me, but it's her best performance.
You're working on a piece about this, right? On Angel Heart.
So I did do a chapter on Angel Heart, comparing it with The Skeleton Key, which I think is really a spiritual sequel to this film, and corrects and reimagines some of the issues that people did have with Angel Heart. And I talk about other parts of the subgenre too, and other tropes and voodoo and horror films. And the edited volume that chapter is in is called The Horror That Haunts Us, Nostalgia, Revisionism, and Trauma in Contemporary American Horror. I think it's out next year.
Send me a link when it's available and I will alert my listeners to it.
Will do. Thanks, Jesse.
I'll sell you some books. Robin, this is a wonderful conversation as always. You are welcome back anytime.
I will take you up on that.
Please come back. And thank you again for suggesting Angel Heart. I love this movie. I hadn't seen it in a long time and I'm still kind of like rattling nervously in the aftermath of it because it's as filmmaking, it's just so skillfully done.
It is. And it does haunt you. It's one of these films that will stay with you.
Well, Robin Citizen, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks again, Jesse. I hope to come back.
Before we go, I just wanted to remind the listeners that we do have a Patreon and patrons get access to additional bonus episodes. If interested, you can sign up at patreon.com/junkfilter. Please follow us on Twitter at junkfilterpod. The original music for this program was provided by Marker Starling. My name is Jesse Hawken. Thank you for listening.
If I could just hold your charms again in my arms, then life would be complete. Since you've been gone, dear, life don't seem the same.